Welcome to Between Two Rounds. My name is Tariq Wakid, founding partner at Type One Ventures. Today we're here with Anoush from B Capital. How are you, Anoush?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. I'm a venture capitalist. I work with a firm called B Capital. We were founded by Eduardo Saverin, the co-founder of Facebook, Howard Morgan, who started First Round Capital and Idea Lab and Renaissance, and Raj Ganguly, who was an executive at Bain Capital.
Raj Ganguly. That is a cool name.
Yeah. Yeah, he's one of our co-founders, and yeah, we're a global firm. We invest across stages, everything from seed to pre-IPO.
Okay, and we invest primarily in Series B.
Well, funny enough, our name is almost a misnomer. We do primarily seed through A, and then you know our later stage funds do Series C and beyond. So nice. We're kind of left out of the B, but we're B Capital nonetheless.
Okay, that's cool. And how did you get into venture?
Well, I got into venture. I started my career in finance in Silicon Valley. I was an investment banker working with enterprise software companies and, you know, wanted to be closer to the metal, so to speak. And
to the metal.
Yeah, closer nice. To the metal. You know, started to network with entrepreneurs in the Valley and wanted to spend my time helping them build their businesses and helping them raise capital, you know, for their work. And so ended up joining a venture firm here in L.A. after my time in the Valley.
Which one?
BAM Ventures. It was started by Brian Lee, the founder of LegalZoom.
Yeah, yeah.
And spent several years there, had a fantastic time.
You were like, bam, I'm here.
Bam, right now, there in your face.
Now yeah. I can be.
Exactly. Yeah, and we actually co-invested with BCAP when I was at BAM. So I got to know the BCAP folks, and they were starting a new early stage fund, and that's how everything started.
I think it's really important when you're in startups or venture or anything in life, really, it's realizing that maybe somebody doesn't have can't do anything to benefit you in the moment directly, but the way you operate and how you act ultimately could come back and you end up working at somewhere or working with someone. So treat everyone well and it'll ultimately come back to benefit you. And that's a testament to that. You know, I always think about sayings. You said, put it to the metal.
Yeah.
Right. And how those sayings could get started. So like balls to the wall. Yeah. Do you know where that comes from?
Balls to the wall. No.
Where does it come from? It's from flights. When you would do the throttle on a flight, there's two balls on the throttle and you put them to the wall.
Ah, got it.
Right. And so it's crazy how some of these sayings get taken and used everywhere. And I'd love to understand where the metal analogy came from.
Yeah, I think it comes from kind of the industrial workplace, you know, working with, I think it's from the automotive industry, like getting closer to the metal means being on the factory floor and actually building something and sort of being there kind of on the ground level.
What do you focus on when you invest? Like what gets you excited when you talk to founders to get involved?
There are a few things that are, I think, core to what we look at and what excites me when I'm investing. Number one is, you know, does the founder have some sort of unfair advantage, right? Mm. It could be anything. It could be some sort of technical depth that their team has. It could be some sort of distribution advantage, the ability to sort of commercialize a product and get it out there. It could be some sort of like regulatory insight or some sort of insight that allows them to take advantage of something new that's changing in a market.
Sure.
So those sorts of things are really exciting to me. I'm primarily focused on working with the right kind of founder as opposed to anything else.
Right.
So we work across different industries and different, you know, to some extent, different stages of businesses. The real important point is working with a founder that we think is special, that is doing something different, that has some sort of advantage where we can actually help tilt the odds in their favor a little
bit. Sure. Do you go off gut feeling? Do you ever meet someone and say, this person is great, I don't know why this person is special? Or have you, that's my stomach grumbling.
Gut feeling.
It's a gut feeling. You're a good guy. Have you ever like documented what makes someone special systematically? Or do you think it comes more of on the people, the soft skills?
I think it does come across on soft skills. We've tried to document things, but there's so much variety mm-hmm. in what makes someone special that mm-hmm. I think it's been pretty tough to do that. I think if you're in the industry long enough and you've met with enough people, you start to have a certain intuition around someone when you're around them.
It's like intuition. Does that intuition come from a pattern recognition that you subconsciously have built?
Probably.
Right? And it's for me, I've never been able to figure out what attracts me to a certain founder or a certain, like systematically. I can get a good gut feeling. And actually, Daniil on our team is very analytical. And so I'll say, I have a good feeling about this. And he'll tell me why I have a good feeling. And I'm like, you're right. That's why.
Some things you can explain and sort of document. Some things I think you can't. Sometimes it's just a energy level or it's a level of insight or someone's charisma even. I mean, I think those are all really important things that sort of hard to quantify or hard to sort of note down in any kind of discrete way.
Right, right. And in this world, it's so many variables are involved. Timing, things are going to change in the future, projections change, people change, industries change. And so honing it in to get the best outcome as whether you're a founder or an investor is truly, that's why they say it's an art, I think, because it's very hard to quantify what makes somebody good, what makes a company good, what makes it a company that could be quote unquote bad could ultimately end up being a great success. And so there's it's an interesting world to play. How long have you been in venture?
Been in venture for about 6 years.
Okay. Do you think this is your home forever, or do you think you'd ever go into the founder world? Or
I feel best suited to the venture world. I think that it's one of these industries where if you have an insatiable curiosity like I do, there's no end to the things that you can research and sort of be involved with and educate yourself on.
Sure.
It's very humbling at the same time. But especially for me, it's something that really satisfies that itch in terms of being around something that's constantly changing and being able to satisfy that curiosity like time and time again.
Yeah. I've noticed that a lot of investors have ADHD.
Yeah.
I'm included. But I think that you can take that and manifest it in a positive way.
Exactly.
And it's always, if I had to do the same thing day in and day out, read the same thing, maybe I'd be an expert at that one thing. They always say, a jack of all trades, what is the quote?
Jack of all trades, master of none.
Yeah, but there's a full saying, and we can pull it up on screen. It's a jack of all trades is a master of none, but better than a master of one. Ah. That's the full saying. So if you know many things in terms of like high level and many industries, you can draw correlations to all those industries. And I think that's what we're best suited because, not because we're smarter or what have you. VCs tend to think maybe we have this power dynamic where we're smarter than other people. But no, we just get views into a lot of different things and can pull those similarities and patterns together. And were you born and raised in LA?
I was, yeah. Okay. Born in Pasadena, raised in Pasadena, spent college years back east, spent early career years in the Bay Area, but back now in California after realizing my blood wasn't thick enough for me to stay anywhere else for too long. So, yeah, this is definitely home, and it's an exciting place to be, especially if you're in tech,
yeah,
right?
I mean, that's because we're brown. It's summer in LA, and I'm wearing a long-sleeve shirt, so my blood isn't thick enough either.
Right.
And where would you go to college in out east?
I went to the University of Pennsylvania.
Okay, UPenn.
Yep.
That's so you must have been real smart.
I did my homework.
Okay, I didn't. And so what gets you going on a personal level? What do you like to do in your free time, you know, when you're not working?
Yeah, I'm one of these people who's if you've heard of like the quantified self.
No, I haven't.
Essentially, It's folks that are kind of obsessed with sort of measuring their bodies and like their biological processes. And
oh, like biohacking?
Kind of like biohacking.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. So I do a lot of that. Right. And so
you do look very young.
I'm older than I look. So maybe something's working. It's working. Yeah. Biohacking. Right. Exactly. So basically, you know, I do HIIT training. I do like other forms of like physical fitness and things like that. I run races.
What kind of races?
10Ks, 5Ks.
You ever done a marathon?
I've done a marathon, yeah.
Okay, nice. I did one marathon.
Okay.
I suggest you train. I didn't train for the marathon.
Oh, yeah.
But wow. I finished it.
Wow. Hey, if you didn't train and finished
a
marathon.
A guy dressed up in a Hershey syrup chocolate suit beat me. But I got the marathon done. So you do a lot of health and fitness.
Health and
what
fitness.
Other things do you do for biohacking or what did you call it? What did you say it was called?
The quantified self.
The quantified self.
Yeah, a lot of it's like measuring and like benchmarking kind of where you are.
Okay.
Like there's a stat about, you know, your lifespan and how you perform on certain activities correlated to like your lifespan.
Like metabolic age?
Kind of like that. It's sort of like, you know, if I can run a sprint in a certain amount of time, if I can run a mile in a certain amount of time, then there's a high correlation that like I'll be able there's a high correlation that like my lifespan is within a certain band.
Interesting.
Right? And like it varies based on your current age. And the other kind of weird thing about that is like you can't make up for lost time, right? So if I wanted to make myself physically fit now and I try to do the same thing 10 years from now, I wouldn't get the same benefit 10 years from now.
Right.
Right? I'd be far behind the curve in terms of being able to expand my lifespan.
Yeah, you can't do preventive care once you've had done all the damage.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, I have like various devices and like data sets and things like that. Actually, it's just kind of nerdy, but like, you know, I compare myself to these various benchmarks to figure out you know, what my epigenetic age is.
Epigenetic age. Yeah, I've heard of that.
And
so there's a certain max age humans could theoretically be 120 because of the telomeres,
right?
And so do you think that we'll innovate around being able to extend human lifespans beyond that?
I think we could. I think we could. I think it'll take some time. I think it'll take our sort of integration with technology that maybe doesn't exist quite yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's possible to maybe extend that, you know, some time ago.
I've seen a lot of innovation or companies working on innovation in that space. It's a little bit over my head. Avanticon, our team, is the expert that handles all our bio and healthcare focused stuff. But I personally am super interested. This year, you know, I was in my 20s, all I cared about was work and success in career. So I put all my energy to that. And I like didn't exercise, didn't put importance into that.
Yeah.
Wasn't eating right. I was traveling all the time. And this year I made a shift. You know, I said, okay, I need to prioritize this. I need to be healthier. I need to eat right. I need to think about what I'm eating and how that's impacting me.
Yeah.
And it's completely changed my outlook on life. So when did you get into the quantified self?
About, I would say 7 or 8 years ago.
Oh, wow. Did something spur that on?
I'd gotten married. I knew we were going to start a family at some point, and I thought, okay, well, I should probably like fix whatever things I need to fix at this point.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's good. It's always a woman that makes you a better man.
That's exactly right.
And do you have kids?
I do. I have a young daughter, a 3.5-year-old daughter.
Congratulations.
Yeah,
that's,
thank you.
That's beautiful. And what other things does a quantified self focus on?
You know, it's really...
Because I'm sure it's like a rabbit hole you keep going
deeper. Yeah, it is a rabbit hole you keep going down. I mean, the two biggest pieces of it are kind of... Well, maybe there's three, right? There's nutrition, there's activity, and then there's lifestyle.
Mm.
And so it's attempting to optimize those things within your life circumstances and using whatever tools or kind of like remedies or behavioral changes you need to make those happen.
Interesting. Have you heard of like prolonged fasting and the benefits of that?
I have.
You know, I started doing that this year.
Okay.
Doing 3-day water fast, and then the whole team started doing 3-day water fast. Like Abdo will do it. CJ, I think even Nina, everyone kind of like dabbled in it. And there's a lot of studies done because, you know, obviously in certain religions, you fast.
Sure.
And they have those data sets that show the benefits. And you go into this thing called autophagy, where the body starts eating itself, but it eats the inefficient cells, right? So if you have all this abundance of food and energy, your body lets cells that maybe are inefficient using of the energy, and they become precancerous or what have you, autophagy kills those cells internally. It starts eating itself. I lost like 25 pounds.
Wow.
Over a span of like 4 months, just working out, eating right, and doing prolonged fasting and or intermittent fasting. It's hard.
Yeah, it's hard, but that's exactly right. Autophagy is definitely something that is the body's sort of cleansing system for these cells that are, you know, kind of for whatever reason, like not functioning properly or need to be removed from your system. So yeah, that's a real thing.
It's crazy how the ancient wisdom had so many health benefits, and now we have to like go into science to actually believe that. It's like we were telling you all along, you know?
Yeah.
I find myself clearer in the mind when I'm fasting. Takes like the first 24 to 36 hours to get past that weird, like, oh, I want to eat food. But when you realize that you are not starving because you have stored energy, it's just your body secreting this thing called ghrelin to say you need to eat. But once you get past that secretion of that hormone, you're not hungry. You're like, oh, I haven't eaten in 2 days and I feel good.
Yeah.
I'm like, and you go into this like limitless state where you're just like in the zone. So I find that really cool.
Yeah.
Love to learn more about the quantified self. If you have any books that you would recommend.
Sure.
Any books on that?
There's one called Outlive.
Outlive.
Really interesting book about just how to expand the human lifespan.
Okay.
To your point. And it has a lot of good techniques and also some interesting data around how to do that.
That's cool. Yeah. I looked into this thing called the longevity escape velocity. Have you heard of that?
No.
So there's this theory that humans could live forever. And the theory states that because technology increases exponentially, in all of human like existence, there's an average life expectancy. And that's been increasing for some odd years that it didn't increase, but it's been increasing ever so slightly since the beginning of time. You know, people used to live to their 30 or 40, and now we are 70, 80-year life expectancies in the first world. With every year that passes, human life expectancy, because of innovation around technology and better healthcare access, et cetera, will increase maybe at a 0.01 year of increased life expectancy for every year that passes. When that curve, for every year that passes, we increase by 1.1, then you're essentially adding 20 years to a lifespan. And in those 20 years, technology continues increasing exponentially. And so you could essentially choose to extend your lifespan forever.
It's amazing. It's like Moore's law for the human body.
Exactly. And so if anybody wants to look it up, it's called the longevity escape velocity. There's some companies that have focused on, you know, early stages of this research.
Yeah.
I think this guy, Aubrey de Grey, he wrote a book about it. I haven't read the book. It sits on my bookshelf.
Another really interesting book kind of on this topic is called The Gene by Siddhartha Mukherjee.
Okay.
This is a really interesting one. He's a doctor and researcher and historian that studied the entire history of the discovery of the gene and everything that went into that. So it's really amazing. Everything from Mendel and the studies on peas, you know, in a farm to today's like, you know, kind of CRISPR technology for gene editing. Really comprehensive. It's a lengthy book. It's like 500 some odd pages. But if you really want to learn about the topic, and it's very entertaining, that's another good one to take a look at.
Yeah, we invested in a company called Junevity.
Okay.
That's doing epigenetic cell rejuvenation. Essentially, the thesis is you can take certain cells and make them younger again.
Right.
And we've seen companies that one company that was targeting the lysosomes in the cell. And as you get older, the lysosomes become less acidic, so they can process less waste. So the lysosomes, like the garbage disposal of the cell.
Yep.
And as you get older, cells die, and then those lysosomes within healthy cells should clear up the waste. And as you get older, things like fatty liver disease, Alzheimer's, et cetera, are caused by lysosomal dysfunction. And so if you could reacidify those lysosomes into old age, you could essentially stop some of these age-related diseases from happening. So some people view age as like a natural occurrence, and some people view age as a disease.
Right.
And if we could categorize age as actually a preventable disease or a reversible disease, imagine what humanity could do.
Yeah.
Imagine what happens when humans live a lot longer, how we start thinking about investing, how we start thinking about humans can only think. It's very hard for humans to not think beyond their lifespan.
Right.
Right? Because I'm not going to be around to get the benefits, so why think so long?
Right.
And so I'm super excited to see innovations. Do you guys invest in these spaces?
We do. Actually, one of the first investments I made when I joined B Capital was into a company called Nest Genomics. And the intent of the company is to develop a longitudinal record of genetic data for humans and be able to apply that to the medical care system. And so imagine like the next time you go to see your doctor, there's not only your family's history that your doctor takes into account and your sort of medical history, but also your genetic history and your sort of predilections based on your genes, and overlaying all of that existing sort of data that a physician has, right? So it allows doctors and health systems to now have another dimension as to how they look at patients and how they can prescribe personalized medicine in the future.
Wow.
or identify other means of sort of like behavioral change or sort of like medical recommendations that they wouldn't otherwise.
If you have those data sets, imagine what you could do with the AI on top of that.
Exactly.
And so that's where the longevity escape velocity comes in. Imagine the convergence of all these fields and how that will impact the human body.
I think it's really amazing. At the end of the day, like genes are simply just code. Right? They're biological code.
Yeah.
So as human beings, we've hacked code in so many different ways at an electronic level. But at the genetic level, I think we're maybe a bit earlier in that process. But in theory, you know, we can find a way to actually help edit or sort of like manipulate that code in a way that creates longevity or creates something that's
so theoretically, more advanced. I could be taller.
You could be taller. you could be better looking, although you are great looking.
Thank you.
But yeah, there are many things that you can do to sort of like enhance human life or improve disease, improve reactions to
drugs. Imagine if you didn't have to like go to the beach to get a tan and you could just be like, ah.
Exactly. Turn it on.
That would be cool. Maybe we'll live in that future. What do you think about, well, if they looked at my family history, you'd be like, why does people eat so much hummus? Like, what else do you look at besides healthcare, longevity, that sort of thing?
Yeah, we look at some frontier topics as well. We look at robotics. We look at the intersection of hardware and software. We look at different ways to modernize like the industrial world.
Okay.
What we call that is kind of reimagining old line industries. And so things like manufacturing or sort of working in factory settings, how do we improve that over time? You know, that's such a sort of a relic of the past. I mean, the entire like industrial sort of ecosystem today is a relic of like decades ago.
Sure.
And so how do we find technology to like enhance that, modernize that, bring that into the future?
Yeah, take the existing technologies like AI. I saw a company that's taking robots and trying to replace the garbage trucks. So we'll go through the neighborhoods and then there's like little robots that pick up the trash can and bring it closer to make it more efficient. It's like garbage trucks stop like 20,000 or 16,000 times a day or some crazy number. So the wear and tear is incredible. So if you had robots that would help them stop less, you're essentially making it more efficient. We haven't invested in the company, but I see interesting plays in industrial automation as well. And I find it super interesting. When it comes to robots, what do you think of the humanoid robot movement? Have you guys made a bet?
Yes, we actually have made an investment in this space. The company is called Aptronik.
Aptronik?
It's a humanoid robotics company that develops technology for use cases like automotive assembly and other kind of industrial logistics-based use cases. The company's been around for about 6 or 7 years.
Cool.
And they're on their 8th version of the humanoid robot. And so they've been at this for a long time.
So they're like at Neanderthals right now. We get the Homo sapiens soon.
Exactly. This team came out of the University of Texas, Austin. And, you know, they've been in the robotics space their entire careers. And they developed this new tech that can work, with new actuation technology, which is like actuators are essentially the muscles that robots have.
Yeah.
And so their actuation technology is on its 40th generation. And they're able to apply this in ways that a lot of other humanoid robot players are just starting to understand, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a really interesting company that has a lot of really cool use cases. I mean, one reason why we invested is just thinking about the future of the factory and the manufacturing setting. And, you know, it's hard to believe that human labor is going to continue to do these sorts of tasks, right? There's so much turnover in these spaces right now as it relates to human labor. These are terrible tasks.
And young people don't want those jobs.
Young people don't want those jobs. They're high labor costs.
Like the biggest job in America is a truck driver. And
that's right.
Young people don't want to do it.
People don't want to do it, right? And so
I can go on TikTok and make way more money.
Exactly.
I don't even have a TikTok, so I don't ever think.
Yeah, there are much better ways to apply human intelligence to these problems and to apply technology to these problems. And we think the humanoid robots are, you know, it'll take some time for them to become some sort of mainstream phenomenon. But
sure,
there's so much promise that they have and there's so much ability to offset some of these problems today with labor.
Yeah. We did a company called 1X Technologies.
Yeah.
Previously, they were called Haloti. And the reason we were excited about it is because the joints usually are a rotor, and those are one of the most expensive pieces in the robot. And these guys built it with a pulley system, which is essentially like what we have in the human body, and it makes it way, way more attractive in terms of cost to build. What I still can't get my head around, and maybe you have some insight into this, is where is the value going to accrue? Is it going to be in all the hardware companies that are building the robots, or is it in the AI companies that will run those robots, the brain? Because at some point, wouldn't a robot be a commodity? Wouldn't the hardware be a commodity? What do you think on that?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of both the hardware and the software. I think verticalizing that properly is a really difficult task, right? I think some components of the hardware will get commoditized, but there are other components like the actuators that that Aptronik has, for example, that are patented, that are really difficult to reproduce and really difficult to innovate on unless you have the right kind of talent in place. And so, you know, I think there are components that will be harder to replicate. And I think the software, the thing with robotics is everything's integrated, right? If you change one thing about the hardware, you probably have to change a number of things about the software and vice versa, right? So getting that balance right, getting the trade-offs right in those decisions, that's what makes for an interesting robotics company, not simply like one piece of hardware or just a shell or a frame of a robot. It's how those things interact and how those trade-offs are made as an engineering team. I think that's what makes a company like that special.
That's cool. And then what do you think of like Figure AI or the Tesla bot?
Yeah, look, I think they're really interesting. I think the great thing about Tesla bot, especially and what Elon has done is, you know, he's like thrown down the gauntlet for the industry, right? I mean, he's basically said, you know, by 2030, we're going to have a million of these robots in production or, you know, we're going to start our company is essentially going to be a robotics company more so than a vehicle company over the course of the next couple of decades. So
it's going to have people being carried by Tesla bots instead of riding their Teslas.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that. But I think the important thing is everyone else in the industry has taken notice and said, okay, well, if this is what's happening at Tesla and they're sort of at the edge of all this activity, well, then we should start doing this too, right?
Yeah.
So you're starting to see it's kind of like the same phenomenon when the electric vehicle came out and Tesla was very much a proponent of that, saying that, hey, look, our intent here is increasing sort of the level of exposure that EVs get and increasing the level of competition in the EV
and
industry.
Everyone starts doing it.
Right?
And then Biden calls in the best manufacturers of EVs to the White House and Tesla's not included.
Tesla's not included, yeah.
Like, what?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what the hell? If you don't think like we're being lied to, that should be your first your first thing to look at. But when it comes to, so we talked robotics, when it comes to, you come from an enterprise software background, do you still focus on software primarily?
We do.
Mostly deep tech?
We do a fair amount of software also. I would say, you know, the hardware and the and sort of the intersection of hardware and software is kind of like an opportunistic category for us. But we do spend a lot of time in software in different contexts, right? Whether it's AI, outside of AI, things like that. It's still a big part of what we do.
Nice. What are you excited about in the next 5 to 10 years?
Oh, so much.
That's like not existing yet. Hasn't, like for me in space, there's like things that I look for, like lunar companies. And then in the 5 to 10 years, hopefully companies focusing around something around Mars.
Yeah.
Like today we met with a company called Something Galactic. They're trying to create fossil fuels from carbon dioxide here on Earth at cost parity to terrestrial, like to drilling for fossil fuels. And then you could use that technology on Mars to turn the carbon dioxide atmosphere, their long-term vision, into jet fuel.
Yeah,
that could be used by the rockets out there. So there's obviously a play doing those technologies today on Earth. What are you excited about beyond? Because I'm like, I'll talk space all day.
Yeah.
Anything else specifically?
Yeah, a lot of different things. I would say a top couple of things on my mind are, you know, one is autonomous mobility, you know, and how we get to an actual sort of like level five state of mobility, whether it's with automobiles or whether it's with other forms of hardware. I think that's really interesting. You know, being able to develop computer vision and control systems in a way where a robotic piece of hardware or a vehicle is essentially autonomous in the way it moves.
Right.
I think that's really exciting, right?
Well, do you think computer vision will unlock that? Because if you look at the human body, I can grab this cup without looking at it. But a robot has to have its compute, like its vision to know like grabbing it or how hard to grab it. I know how hard to grab this cup because I can feel how hard it is.
Yeah.
If it was soft or it was like a fruit, I'd squish it if I'm a robot.
Right.
So do they have sensory yet embedded in the robots?
So that's being developed, right? There are a few companies working on that. And, you know, tactile sense, we take it for granted.
Yes.
As such a mundane activity, but actually trying to reproduce that with
sometimes
technology.
Tactile sense is the most fun part of being a human, but anyway.
Yeah, but yeah, you're exactly right. And, you know, I think that's something that's under development. I think that actually will, if you can get the compute costs managed in that process, and if you can get the tech developed in a way where it doesn't sort of break the bank for the actual operating cost of a unit, I think that'd be a really, really, I think it'd be a game changer for the way sort of robots.
Do you look at componentry as well, like a small componentry as it feeds into your larger theses?
Yeah, yeah. We'll look at certain levels of componentry. We'll look at biomimetic parts, things like that. It's very early, though.
What's a biomimetic part?
Something like tactile sense or skin.
Biomimicry, so.
Exactly. Mimicking like biology, whether it relates to muscle or tissue or skin or something like that. We've looked at technology like that. We've also looked at, I mean, outside of the whole robotic realm of things, we've looked at material science, like new forms of construction materials or okay. things like that. You know, today, construction and the building of real estate is responsible for something like 40% of greenhouse gases just in the production process. So finding new, more energy efficient or carbon efficient ways to do that. And perhaps, you know, with materials that are actually stronger or better
right.
than what we currently have. I mean, right. That's a really exciting area too.
Yeah, we invested in a company called Kubi Technologies.
Okay.
And that's they're essentially creating a factory for factories, micro factories they call them. And those micro factories create a kit of parts, and that kit of parts can develop a home and build a home in a day. So they can build one home per day at the cost of like $100 a square foot.
Amazing.
So Abdo loves Kubi. He's joining the board of Kubi. I love it as well. But when we invested, I was like, this Kubi good. And then spelled C-U-B-Y. And then Abdo comes to me and he goes, dude, Kubi just got is getting an LOI or a contract in Ghana. And I'm like, that's gonna be good.
Nice.
And so I love dad jokes. What's your favorite dad joke?
Because
are a dad, right?
I'm a dad.
You must have better ones than me.
Oh, they're really not that good. I will say, being a dad, like my daughter is she's a better negotiator than I am, you know, at age 3.5, because she just says no to everything. Yeah,
that's a good skill to have in a daughter.
It's like negotiating with a terrorist, right? Like, I mean, this is nothing I can do.
That's what you're doing right now. I'm kidding. That's like a Brown joke for those of you that are watching.
That's right.
And what do you want to have more kids?
Maybe have more kids.
What was it like becoming a father? You know, did that change you? Did that change your perspective on life?
Yeah, it changes a lot. I think it puts a lot of things into perspective. I think, you know, I mentioned kind of the health thing that I kind of got into when I got married. And, you know, when I had a kid, I think it just made that all the more important, right? And it helps you organize your life in a certain ways. As much as, you know, when I became a father, I think everyone goes through this. Things are overwhelming for the first few months and you're trying to figure out, you know, how to make your entire life work. But then you realize that, okay, well, this gives me a reason to then prioritize things further, cut out the things that are not important, and really just focus on like the essentials and what's going to make, you know.
Say no to more things, like your daughter.
Exactly. Say no to more things. It's a lesson both directly and indirectly.
You know, I've recently, maybe like the last year or so, I used to say yes to a lot. And like try to do a lot of things at once and then like overbook or overcommit to things. And it's certain people pleasing in a sense, or like fear of missing out. And now I'm more comfortable saying, no, this is not serving me right now, or I don't want to do this right now. And so that's a really good skill, an underrated skill to have.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's already got it at 3.5.
Yeah, right.
So this is good. We're on the right track. It gives me a good gut feeling about where your daughter's headed.
Exactly.
And what are some bucket list items for you personally that you want to do in your lifetime?
Yeah, bucket list items.
Places you want to go, things you want to see.
Yeah, you know, I want to see, I want to go to Greece. I've never been there.
Okay.
Want to check out the ruins, want to just check out, you know, there's so much.
You've been to Rome?
I've been to Rome.
How often do you think of the Roman Empire?
I think about it every so often.
I think about it every day.
Okay.
Yeah, every day. I'm actually going there in like a week.
Nice.
Like a week and a half. Closing a deal in Rome. It's just like perfect.
Wow.
Like, my name is Julius. Caesar. I'm kidding. So you want to go to Greece?
Yeah, I want to go to Greece. I think, you know, if you're I'm also kind of a history nerd. And
me too. Let's talk history.
We should talk history. Yeah, I mean, Greek culture has influenced so much of everything, right? Like our architecture, our legal system, our society.
Philosophy.
So much of what we do.
Frat parties with togas.
There you go. That's another great contribution by the Greeks.
I wore a toga in college.
It was great.
Painted my hair white. It was weird.
Oh, you should have.
We're not putting that on screen.
You should have come dressed up with that here today.
No. But anyway, so they influence so much, and that's why you want to go.
Yeah, feta cheese, you know, all that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. So you want to go to Athens? Maybe do the islands or
the Greek Isles, Athens, all of that. You know, the volcanoes.
The volcanoes, nice. Yeah. They also probably influenced Rome. Because they say that, you know, Troy was technically in Turkey, what is Turkey today. But when Troy fell, they say that some of the people from Troy settled in the Italian peninsula near Rome. And so the history was that Romulus and Remus came from Troy. And the founding of Rome was because of that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
And so what other things in history, you know, do you love?
Yeah, well, shout out to another book that I read a while ago by Will and Ariel Durant called Lessons of History.
Okay.
Really good one. If you haven't checked that one out, it's sort of a compendium of all of human history and like sort of the takeaways of what happened in every epoch and even overall what it tells you about human nature and things like that. It's actually a relatively short book, so they condensed all this information into a really short, you know, 100-page book that describes these major lessons of like what happened. And so some really cool takeaways, like one was in all of history, maybe 10% of the time, there may be 10% of the years of all of human history where there wasn't a war.
Really?
And there were wars in 90% of all the other years of history.
Interesting.
So it tells you something about human nature, right?
Well, if you take that and you graph wars and deaths, percentage of population from history to now, we've never lived in a more peaceful time,
right,
with less wars ever. But we think that we are in such a turmoil-filled era because we have so much access to the information. There could have been a war, you know, for that your neighbors were having. You wouldn't found out about it because you're just in your village and,
right,
you know?
Right, exactly.
It's crazy. It's crazy. And in all of history, there's probably been the people who started the wars didn't fight the wars.
That's right.
Put them on the front lines. We'll see how many wars we have.
Exactly, exactly. So, yeah, lots of really interesting things about yeah, one of the other conclusions was just like, you know, there really is no equality in human nature and in life. Like, natural resources are not distributed equally. You know, human populations aren't distributed equally. There really is no reason to believe that, like, equality is something that anyone is entitled to, right?
So I agree. I mean, maybe equality of opportunity is where I'd, as where I'd draw it,
yeah,
if we were to make the argument. I think lack of equality of outcome is normal.
Right.
If you had equalities of outcome, like Kamala's campaigning on that, like equality of outcome is essentially like, doesn't matter if you started, if you worked your butt off,
yeah,
somebody who didn't work as hard as you has to have the same as you and you have to have less. It's been tried many times in history.
Yeah.
The idea of equality is great. Institutional equality is definitely needed. But equality of outcome and equality of opportunity are two big different things that we should not play with.
Exactly. Yeah.
I love history. For me, it's crazy. Have you seen Graham Hancock's like out there theory of how there was like an advanced civilization before prehistory and how like a lot of the religions talk about the same thing as a flood? I don't want to butcher the theory. He has a special on Netflix. I forget the name of the special, but it's Graham Hancock.
Okay.
And he's been on Joe Rogan and some of these other podcasts. And it's super interesting because when you – there's like all these megalithic structures that were created. And if you date those structures, there's no way that they were made. Like the pyramids, he says that they were built in the like 18,000 years ago. And if you look at the geological record, the Sahara Desert wasn't – there 18,000 years ago, and there was this thing called the Younger Dryas. So it's just crazy to dive into history and look at the alternate histories or the potential things that we don't know, like before there was written history. What were humans like? Were they like you and me? You know, I would have died. Like when I would have died at like 15. I wouldn't even made it to 15.
Yeah, it's amazing to think about. There's so many commonalities in many cultures of the world, and there's no real understanding of like why that's the case.
Yeah.
Right. So it's interesting to think about maybe an alien civilization or some other like.
I love ancient aliens.
You know, some other like, you know, state of being that we can't understand today, but that may have existed back then.
100%. What's crazy to me is like back to Rome. This guy, Hannibal, took elephants over the Alps.
Oh, man.
You ever hear about
that? Yeah, I have heard of this, yeah.
Yeah, and could you imagine, like, 2,000 years ago, just, like, some dude with no Wi-Fi, no cell phone, just let's take these elephants over these mountains.
Oh, my gosh,
I could barely hike a mountain myself. And so it's crazy what the feats that they've done in history. And I find it super interesting. Another thing about Rome I find super interesting is, you know, tomatoes were found in the Americas.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, all Italian food now has tomatoes in it.
Oh,
what
wow.
What did they eat back then?
Oh, my gosh.
Right? They didn't have pizza with no tomatoes.
Amazing. I read a book about the history of pizza. Oh, my gosh. Really, really amazing book.
I love how we started talking BC and now we're talking about the history of pizza. That's probably the most interesting part. What did you learn about that?
Oh, really amazing. So pizza was originally just like a really it was considered food that very low-class people ate in Italy, right? It was kind of like the street food that nobody respected. And then over the course of time, you know, I think there was one, I forget, it was like a some sort of member of the royal family, like a queen or a prince or somebody, that requested that pizza be like sort of served or prepared kind of in their palace. And that was like a tipping point where like it became something that people actually thought of as a respectable food that people could eat. And then it talked about like how it moved to the obviously the United States many, many generations later and what it's meant. There's actually one company today that supplies something like 60% of the cheese that goes onto pizza. I forget the name of the family, but it's like
can we go get them as LPs?
Yeah. Probably worth it because they're multi-billionaires.
I'll make them more cheese.
All of the Papa John's pizza that you eat, they supply all of that.
I don't eat Papa John's pizza.
Okay. Well,
I told you I was like fasting and stuff. Papa John's would like kill it. I do want one though.
Well, maybe it's worth it just for the taste of this one cheese for this LP. I mean, you can tell them that, hey, look, I ate Papa John's just so that you would write me a check.
We also have this pizza thing in Lebanese cuisine. Called Manaish. It's so good. That has a lot of cheese. I bet that they don't supply that cheese. That's probably some...
That's a unique cheese, probably.
That's a unique cheese, yeah, yeah. Anyway, so, no, I appreciate you being here. Last question for me, it's what's your favorite movie? And please don't say Borat, because Caroline said Borat, and we went to 10-minute, like, in Borat. And if you and I did Borat impressions, and we're both brown, like, it'd just be weird.
Oh, yeah. Probably not a good look. Favorite movie, Goodfellas.
Why?
You know, it's one of these classic gangster movies, and I just think that it's, for its time when it came out, it was just such a, like, iconoclastic movie, right? Mm. It was so different, like, the dialogue, the talk about, like, the mafia and, like, you know, the sort of, like,
back to the Roman Empire.
Back to the Roman Empire, right? Yeah.
All the roads lead to Rome.
Yeah, just, I just think, like, the rawness and the directness of it was, like, really interesting. It was very well narrated as a movie. So,
that's cool. Yeah. That's cool. Mine is Robin Williams' What Dreams May Come. Have you watched it?
I have, yeah.
It's really good. It's not his, like, most famous movie, but it's just the storyline behind it and what happened to him after he shot the movie 20 years later, and, you know, he committed suicide.
Rest in peace. What a phenomenal
he
talent.
He was such a good talent. Yeah. It's sad we've lost him. But, yeah, I'm a big movie guy, big book guy, and big history guy. So I feel like we have that in common,
yeah.
And we also do venture. So look forward to co-investing with you and building some cool companies, maybe living forever.
Yeah, maybe we'll live forever and do it for a very long time. So.
Yes, yes. Thank you for being here today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.